Hi folks, this is Craig here. I wanted to begin this episode of Acid Horizon with two very important messages. The first is that Black Lives Matter. All of us here on the show are committed to ending white supremacy in the United States and around the world. Furthermore, we acknowledge and support the struggle of Black people and other people of color to overcome this persistent form of oppression. The second message is that we want to thank our new patrons for supporting us in our endeavor to cultivate a widespread passion for theory. We want to thank you by name at the end of the show. Now, without further ado, here's today's episode. This is Acid Horizon, a theory podcast which confronts global crisis and the specter of a world that could be free. This is episode 4, Michel Foucault and the Politics of Health. We also discuss Michel Foucault's essay, What is Enlightenment? Thank you for joining us. Welcome to Acid Horizon, the theory podcast. Today I'm joined by Matt and Will for our discussion of Foucault's essay, The Politics of Health, which can be found in his compilation of essays, Power Knowledge, Selected Interviews and Other Writings from 1972 to 1977. Our review and treatment of this work comes at a time in our history at which the world faces a global health crisis in convergence with its many other crises. Our purpose is not only to make connections with the politics of the here and now, but also use this essay to describe Foucault's methodology and determine what it might hold in store for us in terms of the theoretical tools it presents for matters at hand. This episode was Will's brainchild, and Foucault happens to be a very good friend of Will's. So I will defer to Will during this discussion quite often. So, Will, perhaps you could start us off by telling us, what is Foucault up to in this piece, and where is this piece situated among Foucault's other works?
So what Foucault is up to in this piece is he's trying to discuss the birth of a new form of politics, but one that is born out of medical practices, an area that in conventional political historical analysis is generally kept separate. And that's still true now in the way we treat politics, right? One thing that Foucault would argue is that political structures tended to be kind of treated as separate entities from the medical at a superficial level. But what we see in this essay is that that's not entirely true. In fact, the political was heavily reliant on these structures of medicine, of family, of policing, and some of this is still true today. I'd like you to think briefly about the way that we've been treating the coronavirus crisis in the United States. What were kind of liberals hoping for every single day at 5 p.m. Eastern time? They were waiting and waiting and waiting to hear from Dr. Anthony Fauci, which in the 1990s became kind of a political figure. The politics of health is one that informs all other politics. And what Foucault starts to try to do here is show kind of broadly, and he does this throughout his corpus, how one feeds into the other. And this gets kind of clarified particularly when we see the birth of urban centers and the rise of hospitalization and the political processes that surround that, the compartmentalization of these buildings, the way in which these general hospitals serve both a medical role for the individual, right? You have an illness, you want to get it cured, you go to this space and they deal with it, but also one that deals with societal ills, right? When we talk about corruption, right, the term corruption, we think of things like Richard Nixon or the Nixon campaign discussing things with the North Vietnamese, the Watergate break-in. But corruption goes far back to the medical age. So there's both a philological association, but also a practical one. And then you see these hospitals taking in folks like vagabonds, those who could not work or would not work. And I think the asylum is the final solidification of this practice. But what Foucault is doing here is laying out a methodology to show that these sorts of relationships are not clear cut. In fact, you know, they are reliant upon one another.
One of the things that I want to get at pretty early on in this discussion is Foucault's methodology. There's three words that come to mind for me when I think of Foucault. Those are power, truth, and right. And in relation to this essay, The Politics of Health, I mean, it's pretty clear that all of these concepts are at work in this essay. The question is, to what extent are all the agents who hold power or who have power exerted on them by those in the medical field and those who have been subjectivated through these structures of power? And to what extent does truth or the notion of science impact the dynamics of power? And to whom are certain kinds of political right conferred? I wanted to begin just by talking also about the three modes of objectification in Foucault, and I think this is something to keep in mind. This is something that I pull from his essay, The Subject and Power. And there are three things that transform human beings into a subject. The first being modes of inquiry, which would be something like the sciences of a subject, languages, economics, biology, in this case, medical science. And also what Foucault calls dividing practices. Those practices are routines that separate things into categories of good and bad, criminal and good citizen, sick and healthy. And then just the notion of subjectivation itself, the process in which the self is self-instigated, or the self comes to recognize itself as a self as it is inscribed by a particular system of politics.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start methodologically, particularly as it relates to the juridical role that individuals in spaces of medicine have. Foucault makes this very clear in the opening chapter of Madness and Civilization, where he argues that the Hôpital Général played more than just a medical role, that doctors on the floor there were not just determining, you know, physical illnesses of an individual, but they also had to determine sort of a moral certitude there. They had to find sort of a level of self-understanding within the realm of morality in their subjects. So the issue here was not simply just that of medicine, but it was that of criminal law, of politics, of even broader systems of justice. And all of this goes back to Foucault's treatment of the Enlightenment. You know, he is using the tools that the Enlightenment gives him and turning them back on Enlightenment thinking. You know, the byproducts of the Enlightenment, these concepts of truth, of the universal man, of rights, which plays a really important role in Foucault, where in sort of a post-Lockean sense, Foucault is going to truly stab at this concept of universal human rights in a way that shows that once they're guaranteed to a population, they can just as easily be taken away. And, you know, part of this was discussed by Hannah Arendt earlier, and I'm not going to reject that scholarship, but Foucault takes it to a level of true material analysis, where he shows that in area after area where we deem kind of these ideas of man, there's also this, you know, absurd mirror of individuals who fall out of the norm. And it's those individuals that become problematized to Foucault. It's those individuals that, you know, if one wants to have a different interpretation, get to be sort of a revolutionary subject or a problematized subject within within political discourse.
And I think this notion of the problematized subject that you bring up bears directly on Foucault's own understanding of the Enlightenment. And right now I'm thinking of the Jordan Petersons of the world, who look at the quote-unquote postmodern neo-Marxists who are out to dismiss the Enlightenment whole cloth. I mean, it's just completely wrong. Foucault is not pushing for a rejection of the Enlightenment. He does reject the idea that there were ideal social institutions that were positively ossified in some sort of previous instantiation of them at some point in time. Foucault is actually a supporter of the Enlightenment in its prerogatives, insofar as it's a means of valorizing what he calls permanent critique, the permanent critique of present social conditions and their historical antecedents as the ongoing project of political liberation of autonomous subjects.
And we see this in Foucault's life, right? Mitterrand gets elected and wants Foucault to serve in that government. You know, his staff sees kind of an interest in Foucault's activism. And Foucault steps back. Deleuze is excited that this has happened and writes all of these, you know, great pieces about the rise of the possibility of a French socialist government. Everyone is on board, but Foucault's notably silent. And what he wants to do is maintain the critical distance from all processes of governance. And, you know, some of us could say, well, Will, isn't that an indication that he kind of wants to have it both ways? That he never wants to be held to account for his ideas? And to that, I say Foucault is here to just provide critical support. If you're looking for Foucault to give you an ideal way to structure governance, you've missed the entire point, right? Because he's there to kind of press you into coming to conclusions that these forms of social organizations always find a dangerous element there, and that they can always be utilized in a weaponized manner.
Yeah, and I wanted to say that in terms of the Enlightenment and Foucault, you just mentioned Jordan Peterson. Jordan Peterson, basically, I won't do it by name, but he takes most of his views on the sort of post-structuralist thinkers and others like them from one book. Unfortunately, the problem is that really the Enlightenment philosophically was an inquiry into both the possibilities and the limits of human understanding once it's taken away from the boundaries of religious dogma, right? What kind of things can we know and how can we know them and how far can it go, right? Maybe there is a limit. Maybe there's a limit to how much we can know as humans, but not, you know, we'll find that out later, right? And so the problem you find with people like Jordan Peterson is that people like Foucault, really what they do is they take the Enlightenment to its rational conclusion, in my opinion. That's the real problem, is that they take it more seriously, really, than someone like Peterson does. And so they really start asking questions about not only what can we know and how far can we be sure about it, they also ask very important and very material questions about the structures which have to be in place and are in place such that we, today, us, can claim to know the things that we claim to know. That's one of the things that Foucault, I think, is really, really interested in, both in this piece which Will's chosen and in the other ones, is that he wants to say, yes, we can, you know, we claim we know X, Y, and Z, right? But what is it historically, in a really, really material sense, over our actual history, which has enabled us to be in a position to be able to make those kind of claims? Right. And that's one of the other ways in which Foucault becomes quite interesting to Marxists as well, is that although he was very, you know, he had quite a few criticisms of Marx and Marxism, nevertheless, the stern materialism of what Foucault does, both in this chapter and elsewhere, does give a kind of a meeting point there. He's not really interested in, you know, the way in which ideas inform the development of history per se. I think if you asked Foucault, what does X mean? I think he'll say to you, I'm not interested. I'm only interested in what does X do, right? What is the function of it? What does it actually do materially in the world? I think on the one hand, Foucault in some ways actually instantiates the Enlightenment idea by probing the limits of knowledge and the possibilities of knowledge as well. On the other hand, I think he's also an enduringly modern thinker, in that he's relentlessly materialist. He's not really interested in the idea of Geist guiding, you know, human development or whatever. No, he's not interested in that. He's interested in the function of specific techniques and historical developments and how that affects our thinking today and how it maybe also limits it.
I think you're right, Matt. In what ways does the rationalist Enlightenment project bring to bear in any way on a set of present political circumstances such that it illuminates the path forward to further liberation? I just pulled a copy of What is Enlightenment right now. And for anybody who's ever said that a postmodernist like Foucault was against the Enlightenment, well, here it is. Here's a rejection of that claim. Foucault says this: we must try to proceed with the analysis of ourselves as beings who are historically determined to a certain extent by the Enlightenment. Such an analysis implies a series of historical inquiries that are as precise as possible. And these inquiries will not be oriented retrospectively towards the essential kernel of rationality that can be found in the Enlightenment, which could have to be preserved in any event. They will be oriented toward the contemporary limits of the necessary, that is, toward what is not or is no longer indispensable for the constitution of ourselves as autonomous subjects. It's right there in the text.
Yeah, just a quick bit here. So actually, I'm going to name and shame here. Jordan Peterson's understanding of people like him, their understanding comes from a book by Stephen Hicks. For Hicks, Kant is actually the starting point of the counter-enlightenment. Whereas, of course, any actual philosopher, historian, whatever, would understand that Kant really was one of the key figures in the Enlightenment, right? One of the problems is that although Kant will say, let's probe both the limits of knowledge and the conditions which make that knowledge possible, once you simply dismiss Kant as counter-enlightenment, you don't really have to deal with any of that, right? You can just dismiss Kant and many others, such as Foucault, you know, following Kant's footsteps. You can just dismiss all of them, right? They're all postmodernists, they're all neo-Marxists, you know, they've all read Marx, so they must be Marxist in some way, blah, blah, blah. I'll leave it off there, but I think there's a real issue there where the understanding of what the Enlightenment is and thinkers becomes a problem for understanding people like Foucault and many other, what you might call charitably post-structuralist thinkers.
Yeah, I think what's deeply frustrating about folks like Stephen Hicks and Jordan Peterson, particularly in the way that they relate themselves to Foucault, is, you know, I really do hate doing this because, it became sort of a cultural motif when Jordan Peterson just looked at that one person and said, read more. But I can't help but see a remarkable shallowness of understanding of Foucault and Derrida and, that ilk. Whenever Stephen Hicks or Jordan Peterson speak on these issues, because they seem to just outhand reject it. Look, there are so many people who are guilty of simply rejecting philosophical schools, movements. But the problem here is that they set out to provide a profound critique of it. And when they fail to understand that Foucault's very project is grounded in the very tools of the Enlightenment, at least on the analysis side, at least on the material analysis side of the critique of historical reason, there's something deeply frustrating about it. Because what does the What is Enlightenment essay begin with? Well, it begins with Foucault talking about the history of that question. Foucault's deeply interested in what exactly Enlightenment tools meant. And throughout the essay, he provides qualifying statements like this one. I do not by any means propose to consider it as capable of constituting an adequate description of Enlightenment. And no historian, I think, could be satisfied with any form of analysis in the social or political transformations that occurred in the 18th century. Foucault's entire corpus is based on the transition from pre- and post-Enlightenment philosophy and the socio-political and economico-political transformations that occurred because of this line of thinking. And this very essay that, you know, I pushed on you guys for this today circles around that point of transition. So people like Jordan Peterson, it's frustrating to have to find kind of the nitty-gritty issues with their understanding of Foucault. But I think part of it is simply because they don't understand the way in which Foucault is going about critiquing some of these subsequent values, but also that he's doing it in a genealogical method. Who is one of Jordan Peterson's greatest, icons? Friedrich Nietzsche.
Well, let's get back to talking about what a genealogical method is for Foucault. I think one of the generic statements that can be made about Foucault is that power relations involve these complex distribution of agents, which evolve complexly and so forth. And also maybe for Foucault, something like historicizing power relations, but not verticalizing them, that kind of statement. But I think the crux of his methodology, like you said, does attend to his relationship with Nietzsche and the notion of a genealogical method. And so, Will, maybe that's a good place to sort of dive back into the text. How does Foucault understand the notion of origin in relation to the establishment of social relations, in particular, the relation of society to notions of health?
Wonderful question, because there are so many scholars who attempt to find, unique origins of things. Where did something philologically get its start? Nietzsche wasn't particularly interested
right? The genealogy of morals, particularly the second essay, is much more interested in changes. And Foucault is going to take that method, that spirit from Nietzsche, that practice, and apply it to actual physical institutions. And one thing that he does in this essay is show the emergence, disappearance, and reemergence of the hospital. Foucault's not necessarily interested in the actual origin of something itself. He's interested in two things: the thing's alterations and the representation of that origin throughout time. So in Nietzsche, Genealogy and History, Foucault makes it explicit that in fact, it is the transformation and the way in which these institutions operate that is far more of interest, right? How does it affect us? You know, Matt was saying, you know, I'm not interested in what X is. I'm interested in what X does. But Foucault is interested in what X does. He's also interested in how X has changed, how the understanding of X has changed, and what it's meant to the population under those altering regimes of thought. So for Nietzsche and for Foucault, genealogy is a practice of alteration, right? With Nietzsche, it was the transvaluation, the rise of new forms of morality, the internalization. Foucault will do a very similar thing with the internalization of sexual practices, sexual morality, the treatment of the body, the way in which we recognize our own sexuality, the way in which we identify ourselves as subjects within, you know, ethical fields, finding ourselves lined up with a series of ethical matrices and how we recognize ourselves within them. But it's not about, you know, where did it start? Because that, to Foucault, that won't help us. For Foucault, it's where did it change?
In the beginning of this essay, it seems that he wants to head off some presuppositions that anyone might have about the emergence of the medico-juridical apparatus of the 17th century. And basically, in accord with what you're saying, he regards the quote-unquote origin of medicine not as from folk superstitions to modern medical practices, like there was a direct line going from A to B. And it also seems like he wants to avoid a reduction of the emergence of the medico-juridical apparatus as a relation between the individual and market structures. So maybe you can kind of take us into the text just on that. And one of the sort of implicit questions there is, how is Foucault differentiating himself from, let's say, a Marxist?
The final paragraph of this essay makes the differentiation clear. But you can start to see this differentiation appear kind of by the third-ish paragraph of the essay, where he brings up this concept of nosopolitics, which would be borne out into the biopolitical, the anatmopolitical. But nosopolitics is sort of this understanding of health sitting alongside the political realm, that in order for a state to be effective, in order for a state to be able to compete in a global capitalist environment, or a global capitalized environment, they need to have a population that can outproduce their neighbors, right? France needs to have a particular level of productivity among its workforce, and if it is to compete with Germany. And the reality here is that the birth of industrialization provides this sort of unique incentivization for governments, not just owners of the means of production, but governmental leaders, hospitals, individual health workers, to look at the particular economic output of a member of the working class. That the relations that exist there are not merely between the owner of the means of production and the individual who's alienated from their labor, but it's also the owner of the means of production, the person in the prison, the person at the Hôpital Général, the doctor, the nurse. They're all contributing to this production of power that is far more complex than maybe some of his contemporaries would have seen it. And what I always like about Matt's analysis of Foucault is when he really pins down Foucault's materialist analysis, because it is one that is highly historical and extraordinarily physical, right? He's literally looking at buildings, literally looking at charging documents, at diagnoses. So that's where you start to see him take a leap away from the normal Marxist analysis, because I love this one section of the essay where he discusses the role of the medical establishment in examining poverty. And he goes, an analysis of idleness and its conditions and effects tends to replace the somewhat global, charitable sacralization of the poor. And we see this shift right at the birth of utilitarian philosophy, because no longer are the poor, the misfortune, those in states of misfortune, right, the way we generally understood it through the religious lens. Now, they're failing morally because they're no longer contributing to industrial processes. And he's noting that shift as one that's important, not only to our understandings of morality, but to the way in which we treat actual bodies. So for that reason, I think it's fundamentally different, but it's still sticking really, really stringently to material analysis, as Matt said.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, so just to clarify, whether we can, should we see nosopolitics as the same thing, at least in broad terms, as biopolitics?
Great question. Some say yes, some say no. The problem with nosopolitics is that it's only ever referenced in regards to this particular text.
Right.
So the reality is, I would take nosopolitics to be slightly different. I would see it as a part of the medical gaze, right, of understanding and ranking particular symptoms, understanding and creating systems of organization of bodies, which is a part of biopolitics, right, but it isn't the biopolitical project. So it's not the same thing. It is just another tool in the broader biopolitical project. But I think you're right to see sort of a parallel use here, because, you know, when he talks about the being the problem of health of all is the priority of all. The state of health of a population as the general objective of policy. Well, that sounds like biopolitics, right? Largely because it is. It's a part of the broader biopolitical project. But here, we're not getting to the point of the self-maintaining practices, the emergence of particular hygienes that are tied in with sexual morality and all of these other, you know, regimes of the self. Rather, we're getting institutional analysis. And a stricter Foucauldian would say, no, these are fundamentally separate issues. But, you know, I'm willing to be wrong.
Yeah, no, it just seems to me like there's obvious crossover and similarity between the idea of nosopolitics and biopolitics, right? Yes, there's some differences, as you say, and you're right. But one of the problems that's been raised, and I think I'm sort of sympathetic to this sort of critique, is that what emerges in later Foucault, in his later Paris lectures on biopolitics and biopower, which is, I think, reasonably, you know, relevant to what we're talking about today, is that because of the way in which Foucault analyzes this, he ends up almost having a quite a sympathetic view, actually, to the view of biopolitics, potentially, because it's at least better than previous forms of political power. But how do you think about Foucault and his relationship to the idea of biopolitics and nosopolitics? Because at a certain point, it does appear that he's quite sympathetic to the idea that actually it's not the end of the world, actually, you know, if the government is interested in fostering the health of a population.
I think you're right. And I think that's part of the reason why this discussion about Agamben, contemporarily is so interesting.
Yeah.
I know you and I were discussing earlier before we recorded this podcast, you know, who's going to be the one to bring him up? Sure, I'll do it. I think you're right. You know, when I did parliamentary debate, which is, you know, the sophist's version of philosophy, I had a response that was, Foucault never says biopolitics is inherently bad. And in fact, Foucault was a professor, right? So he participated in the very systems of subjectivation that, you know, he was engaging in an archaeology of. But again, you know, I hate to be the A to Z brainy quote guy, but I will for this one. He's not saying everything is bad. He's saying it's all possibly dangerous. So I love when people bring this up, because I think it, and you and I talk about there's this sort of coldness in Foucault that's kind of, you can appreciate.
Yeah, I do. As someone coming from a sort of Marxist background, I do appreciate that actually in Foucault. But he rigorously sticks to the actual history. Actually, if we can very briefly just clarify. So earlier when I was saying you're not interested in what is X, what I really mean is that he's less interested in a sort of ontology per se. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not interested in the essence of any given thing. He seems to me to be more interested in what does this thing do, right? What is its actual effects? It's the way in which it proliferates. What is its effect in a material way? And that's really where I'd sort of come down on Foucault in a positive way.
I think you would see these same arguments present in Deleuze's account of Foucault, is that largely what he's doing to these systems is what D and G are doing to psychoanalysis. It's not necessarily, they're not necessarily interested in kind of the ontology of Oedipus and, you know, understanding the essence of these Oedipal structures, but they're interested in what these machines do, these social machines do. You know, Foucault uses the word machine as well, because he sees these places that as zones of productivity. And I think one of the spaces where we could have a pretty fruitful discussion is about Foucault's analysis of the family and of police and of hospitalization, all of which emerge in this essay, which is again why, you know, if I had to, if you had 20 minutes to understand Foucault, I'd give you this essay and What is Enlightenment? Because I think What is Enlightenment gives the best breakdown of the history of the tools that he's been handed down, right? But the politics of health in the 18th century nail down everything from the society of discipline to the treatment of the insane, the mad, those who have fallen into folly, and to that of the self-regulating body. So I think you're right, but I want to point out one quote from Deleuze when he writes in Foucault that a machine is social before it is technical, that all of these social relations need to exist prior to these machines finally taking form. And for that reason, you know, I do think that there is a materialist compatibility.
I want to bring it back to the beginning of the Politics of Health essay and just go through a little bit of the history, since that's what we're talking about now. It seems like the 18th century marked a turn in both the perception and practices associated with medicine. And we could say that medicine was dislocated or made distinct from kinds of assistance normally given to the poor in the past. So there was what Foucault calls a sacralization of the poor in previous decades. But with the coming of the 18th century, we have a capitalization of the hospital such that it reconfigures everyone's perspective right down to the moral level. And I kind of want to go back to another thing, and I hope we can bring this into the discussion more deeply. There's a way in which the shift that comes with the establishment of the human subject as a medical subject, a new kind of exclusion occurs, the exclusion of a certain kind of poor person. There's a bifurcation of a good poor and a bad poor. And it seems that that structure there also buttresses this other notion of the good subject of the 18th century, the moral subject. And I want to know, like, how are we to characterize the complexity of introduction of economics vis-a-vis these new moral attitudes that are instituted during this time? How does Foucault square these dynamics? What are the details here?
The details are complicated. The part that I focus on is twofold. One, the bifurcation of those in poverty, right? The charitable interpretation of poverty, this goes away. Foucault writes that the problem is set to the able-bodied poor to work and transform them into a useful labor force, but is also to assure the self-financing by the poor themselves of the cost of their sickness and temporary or permanent incapacitation, to render them profitable, right? This element of utility emerges. And it's largely a byproduct of the industrial era, right? The maximization of profit. So not only does the owner of the means of production, the factory floor manager, need to ensure that his workers are engaged in activities in such a way that they can increase productivity, but governments now and individuals themselves all need to create networks kind of insurance to maintain the productivity of those individuals. Jacques D'Anzelot has a wonderful book that is kind of speaking through this essay called The Policing of Families, of the Policing of the Family. D'Anzelot wrote this thesis with Michel Foucault as his advisor. Deleuze wrote the preface to it. And what he asserts is that the structure and the policing of the family is actually a hyper-capitalized entity. So Foucault's not running away from the transition that occurs in the industrial era. In fact, he makes it quite clear in Madison Civilization that the Hôpital Général had an ethical status, because it wasn't sufficient for the institution to return the mad to a state where they were useful. They also kind of had to become zealous proponents of this idea of utility across the board. So they needed to become the good poor. And the good poor see themselves as units of productivity. This is a strain even in Marxism, right? Alexandra Kollontai says that women will only be liberated if they can prove themselves to be units of productivity. This is something that expands across the political horizon. It's not just the capitalist, and it's not just the floor manager. But on the other end, I think there's something to be said about the role of industrialization and the production in the hospital.
I just want to jump in because there's maybe a token Brit. There's maybe something worth saying here, which is in Britain, obviously we have the NHS, the National Health Service, right? Founded in 1948, if I remember correctly. But the interesting thing about it is that when it was being, you know, the idea was being thought through, legislation being drafted. The idea was that it would be a completely universal, completely free at point of use institution, right? And actually, within very few years of it being founded, all sorts of exemptions started being made for that. Dentistry and opticians, if I remember being correct, the other two big ones, which still carry on today. And so when I read a bit about in Foucault about the transition towards thinking of, you know, the worthy poor or the unworthy poor and so on, right? It's interesting to me, you know, given he's writing in a European context, and yet obviously, you know, he's writing in 18th century rather than, you know, 20th. Obviously, I, you know, accept that, but just in a different context. I think it's interesting, right? Because today in Britain we have, or at least until very recently with coronavirus, we did have many arguments as a nation about the extent to which the NHS should be free to anyone, right? Which groups are worthy and which ones are not, right? Were they born here, or if they haven't been born here, if, you know, how long should they have lived here before they, you know, all this basically racist stuff. And so it's interesting me reading that, seeing, you know, the history of my own country, which, you know, the first national healthcare service in the world, has been having those debates for a long time now, but also particularly recently, in a very intense way, actually. For example, and this I think also touches on some of the other things that Foucault talks about, there's been a lot of debates in a public sense in this country, in Britain, about whether people who, you know, quote unquote, deliberately ruin their health, you know, whether that's smoking or whether that's not doing enough exercise or eating too much, whatever, should they qualify for the same care that anyone else would do under the NHS as others would, right? Because if you're born with a certain type of diabetes, you know, you don't have a choice about that, so that's fine. But, you know, if you simply choose to eat burgers and not exercise, that's your fault. Immediately, you start dividing up. Again, the same division starts coming up again, right? The worthy and the unworthy. Who qualifies for it? Who doesn't qualify for it? It's the same kind of distinction that Foucault picks up on, you know, in the 18th century. But for me, my perspective, I see this happening today in Britain in 2020. And it's been going on about at least five years now, probably about 10, at least, really. And it's horrifying in a way, well, in many ways, you know, horrifying. But Foucault, I think, probably picks up on the early traces of it, right?
Yeah, I think we have a similar system here in the United States, despite the fact that we don't have a very strong socialized healthcare. I would take that even a step further, saying that it's not only that individual bodies are being medicalized, but I would say that our body, especially here in the United States, becomes individuated in our medical system. There are certain parts of the bodies, like you said, dentistry, that may not be included in a healthcare system, but maybe things like a 3-week stress program or something like that might be part of your health package with your employer. And it makes me think that we have made determinations on the basis of capital, which kind of treatment, which parts of the body will be privileged with treatment, even though in a strict objective scientific sense, maybe somebody's dental health will bring to bear with greater impact than anything that a 3-week stress course could do. Also, we were recently working on some curriculum for the men that I teach in jail, and we were talking about the politics of food. And I think about how, for example, the abundance of corn in the United States, particularly how the growth of corn has exploded over the past 30 to 40 years here in North America, and how it has impacted the food market and then brought to bear on people's health. And then that forces the medico-juridical apparatus to react in a certain way to further individualize our bodies. So it's a very sort of complex relationship that not only isolates individuals, but the health system also sectionalizes our bodies in detrimental ways.
Yeah, I think too, though, that we see it does come back to individual bodies too. I read Francis Ryan's book, Crippled, which was on austerity and the NHS. And it seems to be that this is a political phenomenon that continues to manifest itself with this idea of non-productivity among individuals. And I think it's encapsulated so perfectly in your analysis of that the stress vacation can for C-suite employees is paid for, but not necessarily like the coffee runner or the checkout attendant at the one location's dental work will be covered, because they make this sort of utility based equation the vacation is just simply more valuable. But here too, it returns to just the simple fact that our politics is still driven by the utility of bodies. I work and read this stuff primarily through the lens of disability. So I remember even in the Democratic primary debate, there was a discussion about disability. And briefly, all of these candidates just kept talking about how from the most centrist and mildly right-winged all the way to the more liberal candidates, they all kept talking about what they needed to do was find a way to fold these bodies into zones of productivity. We have to find employment for them. We have to make sure that they get to contribute to society. Not only is it almost liberating that you get to contribute to society, but it's something we must do. There's just something so interesting that our politics, even as it surrounds issues like disability, it always must come back to productivity, come back to a maximization of the extraction of utility. So, that discussion about dentistry is just, I think, a perfect one.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know about America in this sense. I kind of speak for my my experience here in Britain. So in Britain, basically, if you're unemployed, there's a system there where you turn up to a job centre and you explain, you fill out forms and so on, talk to someone there about, I've been made unemployed by this company, I was earning X amount and I live here and so on, and we sort out your unemployment benefits, your social security, right? But because they've tried to make such heavy cuts in this area, and again, this is why I think it brings back to this idea of health being this sort of overriding and almost authoritarian principle, we're now at a stage in Britain where people can come in and say, look, I'm diagnosed with terminal cancer and I've got maybe 6 months to live. And the person at the desk there, who's literally got a target to meet for the number of people she rejects per week, right? Or he or she, they will say, you can work for 3 months, can't you? If they say, I've got MS or something, and we say, you could hold a pen to write the paper, so clearly you can work in an office, so let's find you some work, It's horrifying, absolutely horrifying, but it's all about making every single body productive and useful.
What's beautiful about your example, though, is that the technocrats sitting, stamping denied or approved, right, are engaging in medical analysis.
Yeah.
Right? And the hospitals are engaging in analysis of productivity. So this in a sense, all relates back to Foucault's argument that these things are not separate domains, that these domains are reliant upon one another, that they each inform the processes of the other. So, you know, I just thought I'd point that out.
Yeah, no, it's horrifying. And just to maybe bring just another example just to bear on this, possibly less about disability, but also about the other ways in which health and other factors can impact on this issue. There was a story maybe a couple of months ago about a man who, he was a homeless man in Britain. He had to beg for the money to get the bus to the job centre. And by the time he got there, having begged money and, you know, got on the bus and got there, he was about 5 minutes late to his appointment. And so they said, tough luck, you're late. Clearly you don't have a work ethic, so come back next month and we'll start another go at it. So he had to wait a month for his normal social security, right? These bodies are disciplined in such a brutal way right now, particularly in Britain right now. It's just terrifying. It shows, I think, a lot of what Foucault says in this chapter.
One of the things that I think we can bring back in from the text right now is Foucault making the distinction between the Middle Ages and with what happens in modern society with the introduction of the politics of health. Foucault uses a term here that we use fairly conventionally, but Foucault has a very different usage of that term, and that's the word the police. Foucault's basically saying that in the Middle Ages, the functions of power during that time were militaristic and juridical. In modern society, we add to that the optimization of health. And then in the next breath, Foucault will say, together, these functions are managed by what we call, quote unquote, the police. It's pretty obvious to me he's using a non-standard definition of police here, so I was hoping we could unpack that.
Police are those who engage in policing, those who engage in a gauging of accordance to particular social standards. So when we hear the word police, right, particularly in the context now where we're having this really important discussion about brutality and the violence wrought on particularly the African-American and minority communities in the United States. You know, we have a very particular reaction to that word, but Foucault's using it in a little bit of a different sense. He's arguing that policing occurs in all of these spaces, right? Just as the doctor has a medical role, he also has a judicial one, right? He also gets to deem whether or not you're sane, whether or not you're capable of not being confined in an asylum. Foucault will question this segmentation of elements of force. And what instead he will say is that they all kind of interweave. In fact, it's the physical structures that are segmented, not the bodies, not the juridical or medical bodies. Those are actually quite well meshed. So with that, I think we have to engage with the word police a little differently. But what's interesting, though, is, you know, we have these talks about reforms all the time, and I'm reminded of discussions about trying to alter what the police do and don't do, what social workers do and don't do. And the problem here is that it's rooted in the very practices of monitoring the population, that these sorts of transgressions by individuals of authority beyond what we believe is their bounds, right? Like a cop shouldn't act as a person who analyzes mental health, yet he does. Foucault is kind of presenting this as not a unique or new phenomenon, but one that has existed since the inception of these very institutes of authority.
I'm curious because after reading this essay, I got a sense that there were a new set of imperatives that came out of the medicalization of society in the 18th century. I'm wondering, how would Foucault look at the situation in the United States today, where arguably, I mean, many of these standards have persisted at some level, but now the United States, which is somewhat of an aberration amongst developed Western nations in terms of its relative lack of access to affordable healthcare, how might these standards have changed or remain the same in view of the dynamic that Foucault is talking about? And do you think it's the case that the medicalized subject in American society, for example, today, exists under the same imperatives as the folks who lived in the 18th century?
Yes and no, right? Because institutions of analysis and power are always changing, right? So I think of the United States military draft, right? The role that the medical establishment played in deeming bodies worthy or unworthy of combat, right? These sorts of things change. Now a draft is no longer the problem. We shift to just the hyper-focus on economics. But there is a significant material difference between that of the United States and that of the UK, in which the United States is so heavily drowned in utility-based policymaking that I think that argument about the good and the bad poor, right? We see it just so blatantly in the politics of the Reagan era, so blatantly in even the politics, going back to the politics of the Nixon era, that there is a fundamental difference, but the medicalized subject kind of remains the same entity of inquiry. I don't think there has been this sort of re-examination, liberation, whatever you want to call it, of the medicalized subject. There hasn't been this fundamental viewpoint change. No, I don't think so.
Clearly for Foucault, health becomes the object of surveillance, analysis, intervention, modification, and so on. And these functions entail the creation of the edifice of health, as we've talked about today, and the schemes of socialization that we participate in. And in light of what has happened with coronavirus, the media and the medical establishment have maintained the effectiveness in some countries of contact tracing as one of the best ways to stem the spread of the coronavirus. On its face, this has many Foucauldian implications, right? I look at a place like South Korea, they have engaged with contact tracing, and I believe Germany has as well, if I'm not mistaken. And many have opposed the use of contact tracing as they believe it would further enhance the surveillance state's ability to monitor its subjects. That might be true. And if this claim is true about contact tracing, is there a way where we as workers or citizens can still reap the benefits of surveillance technologies while escaping the potential detriments? Or would Foucault look at this situation and say, no, actually, that's not the case. Our ability to surveil subjects and to constitute a medical subject in our society are completely interwoven in such a way that maybe they cannot without extreme legislation.
I think they are entirely interwoven. I think Matt would probably say there's a particular problem with, you know, private companies engaging in this kind of surveillance and then selling the data to the U.S. government, which is what is happening, right? Like the U.S. government is contracting out companies to do this, right? To install thermal cameras in hotels and all of this. So they have access to that data. I don't think you can theoretically put the genie back in the bottle. I'm tempted to respond to say that we already have a form of contact tracing, right? The form of contact tracing that we have up in states like New York, right, is so rudimentary. You call someone and say, who did you meet with for longer than 15 minutes in the past 2 weeks? But I'm going to point to cell phone data that shows where people were at protests. The blinking lights of individuals holding a particular commodity walking through the streets of a city. You know, the surveillance state is almost an antique now. It has been with us for so long. The panoptic society is already an element that we deal with all the time. And I think it is only in moments like this where we see it emerge nakedly in our face. But I would be skeptical to say that there is any way outside of kind of extreme legislating that you can minimize the eventual implications of these sorts of programs, irrespective of the health benefits. I understand that there are serious health implications to what we are dealing with and that there are serious problems that need to be addressed. But no, it's highly unlikely, I think, from a Foucauldian perspective, that this can be done and then simply disregarded, right? Because we see that with the lepers being condemned prior to the birth of the asylum, but we already now have this technology of exclusion, this technology of confinement. So what do we do when madness is problematized in the age of reason? Well, we use the technologies we already have. We use the schemas that we already have. So it might be utilized in this particular way now, but once we build these structures, we will return to them time and time again.
I was just going to add that actually there's an interesting thing that's come up in the UK here again. I'm kind of a token Brit here, but so the NHS has built up a contact tracing app, right? Months, of course, after many countries have already had them, you know, South Korea and others. The problem is because they haven't actually consulted either Google or Apple, i.e. the manufacturers of you know, the vast majority of any phone being sold today. On, for example, iPhones, if you simply put your phone in your pocket, you know, turn the screen off, the app doesn't work. And the thing is that actually, this is why it's a little bit interesting to me right now, is that the reason why that's happened is that both Apple and Google have said to the UK government and to the NHS, by proxy, we're happy, we have an API already ready for this, but we aren't willing to let you use this if what you're going to do is take all of that extremely sensitive personal data and send it straight back to, you know, the government data storehouses to use later. We've got an API already ready here for a very, very limited and express purpose of monitoring and tracking coronavirus. But if you want to go beyond that, we're not going to help you, right? And that's the reason why the UK's recent NHS app for tracing this is so useless. It's because the UK government doesn't just want that data. It actually wants as much data as it possibly can for in the future. And so it's this very weird situation where for once, at least in the UK, I don't know in a global situation, but in the UK, it's actually those two companies, Google and Apple. Apple, I maybe would expect that from. Google, very much I wouldn't. Who have actually been saying, no, there is a serious risk here, right? In terms of privacy and personal data and so on. And who have been saying, you know, we'll help you where we can, but we're not going to give you the right to go that far. I would possibly expect it from Apple. They're quite good on this stuff. But if even Google are saying that, there's something going on there, you know? And so I think governments are looking at this, possibly, and seeing, you know, opportunities for in the future.
These sorts of developments of monitoring sort of the health of the population, these sorts of practices aren't new. What's crucial to this essay is not only the doctor in the hospital, but the nomadic doctor on the countryside, right? Going in and checking up on populations in outskirts towns, you know, doing the daily rounds. And then we kind of see this formulating in, well, the Oedipalized family, right? Everyone has a siphoned off section in a house, and the focus shifts away from sort of the family unit and towards the family unit's treatment of children, right? The health of the child, the insurance that this child will be a unit of productivity, will be able to fold well into society. So these sorts of concerns about health existed long before, you know, people were applying to be contact tracers in like Suffolk County, right? Like before you hit someone up on the cell phone and said, hi, I'm from the State Department of Health. We just want to know who you talk to because you've got coronavirus. You know, this sort of thing is not new. So when you see this sort of outrage brewing in the United States, there's a little bit of a frustration because like it's not any form of technology that's not already existed, that you've not already, you know, perpetually been exposed to, right? So in the little bonus episode that we did for Docile Bodies, you know, we speak about the role of, you know, exposing people to these modes of discipline perpetually throughout their lives. Well, we've already done that with health. So I understand the concerns about data and all of that, but this data is, there's already, you know, a remarkable amount of health data that's collected by all sorts of entities all around the country. I would just caution a little bit about getting too, you know, outraged, about Agamben getting too upset about the realities of the current situation.
Although I will say, I mean, this is risky, right? I mean, saying anything in defense to any extent about Agamben right now is a risky move, right? I suspect that within the next 5 to 10 years, at least a decent proportion of what he said probably will be vindicated. The extent to which he simply leans into full-on anti-medicalism is really dangerous, actually. And there's some interesting stuff by, who was it? It was, maybe I'll find it a moment later, by French philosopher he's quite good friends with, who tried to dissuade from having a heart surgery as well. Agamben has these real issues there.
I know this story. I was speaking with a professor at a university a few months ago, and he was talking about that whole process where Agamben tried to convince someone he knew not to get heart surgery. Had he successfully convinced him, that man could be dead.
Yeah.
You know, Foucault's not engaging in that kind of anti-medicalism, right?
No.
This is a weird byproduct of Foucault's thought, in the same way that, you know, some of R.D. Lang's anti-psychiatry stuff, the fringier stuff, is a, you know, kind of unintended byproduct of projects like Anti-Oedipus.
I will say there is nevertheless something interesting and something worth thinking about with regards to the kinds of forms of discipline we've seen, which are, you know, accepted in different countries, you know, even between here in the UK and there in the US, the forms of discipline we've seen, the use of data and so on. There is something to bring back to Foucault. You know, Foucault says, you know, I'm not saying it's you know, bad, I'm just saying it's dangerous, right? I'd say I think that it's reasonable to say something similar, right? Which is that we're dealing with an almost unprecedented catastrophe right now of global health, and in that sense, probably proportionate, right, to use these kinds of strategies. But that doesn't mean they aren't potentially dangerous, right? And that's why they're worth thinking and talking about, I think.
One way we can bring this back to the text is talk about how these practices inform the ways in which we view politics, right? The things that we expect of governing structures. You know, we demand that there are a myriad of medical personnel available for the social body, right? The very fact that we describe things as the health of the social body, right, shows the impact that medical processes have on political discourse. So I think, you know, the alterations of practices and the alterations of approach to these very topics are indicative of their importance. So I think just one thing to always keep in mind is the fact that Foucault is not going to play either or in his analysis. It's part of the reason why, you know, he's hypercritical of the traditional Marxists, is because, you know, he's worried about things that are at once both political, economic, and even, you know, sometimes medical. I think it's important to see the ways in which, even now, with all of this, you know, awful stuff going on as it relates to coronavirus and just the terrible tragedy of this whole thing, it's going to impact the way in which we interact with each other at the political level.
I think maybe now is a good time to talk about why we brought this text into focus. And as we talked about prior to the podcast, this would be a very good text of Foucault's to sort of get the full scope of what it is that Foucault does, because it encapsulates so much of his work in such a short amount of space. What could somebody like a Marxist or somebody committed to another form of social theory or analysis gain from an engagement with Foucault? And maybe another way to pose that question is, what is something that a Marxist could interface with in this analysis, maybe add to the Marxist analysis? Or what is something that Foucault delivers that maybe Marxism does less of, or even not at all?
So I think one reality here is that Marxists that find themselves allergic to post-structuralist analysis do a real disservice to their own political pursuit. Because the reality is that when Foucault says that some forms of Marxism exist in the 19th century like a fish exists in a bowl of water, in that it can't survive anywhere else, you know, he says that in The Order of Things. He's right, because the economic analysis refuses to advance into new forms of social control, new forms of productivity, and they remain kind of stringent in this realm of worker relations that in some ways finds itself antiquated in comparison to contemporary social organizations. But the one thing that I would say is Foucault is doing something similar in that, you know, Sartre has this discussion about two boxers in Critique of Dialectical Reason, where he says there are two boxers and they're fighting. But there's also the ring. There's also the fact that they're enclosed in a certain space. There's this particular buoyancy to the floor. It's not just a battle between two individuals. That social conflict is way too simple. There are all of these other factors. And Foucault is interested in the referee, the bars, you know, the stiffness of the gloves. You know, Foucault is engaging in other material analysis of the conditions of existence that sometimes Marxists don't engage in. Sometimes they reject it offhand and look at things as strictly labor relations. Foucault, I think, would argue that sometimes it's a bit more complicated, and I think sometimes he's right.
I agree. I've never really seen a problem personally. And again, maybe I'm wrong here, but I think I've possibly come from a slightly more sort of indebtedness to Marxism than Craig or Will here. But I've never really seen a problem with Foucault and Marx in the sense that they're both indebted to a relentlessly materialist, historical materialism, right? That's their fundamental perspective. And in that sense, I don't think there's necessarily a conflict. I think it says something that people like Antonio Negri, who we discussed a few weeks ago on, Hart and Negri's Empire. But Foucault is central to that book in his analysis of biopolitics. Negri wrote a book on Foucault, just nothing but Foucault, for that reason. I don't see any particular fault in that. There will be issues you have to kind of iron over, I think, or find ways of resolving. Foucault was not a Marxist, right? He never was. If I can say one last thing, just an anecdote, actually, is that there's a very interesting interview, and I can't know exactly where it was, but if you Google some of the related terms, you can find them. He did an interview where he admitted that actually, if he'd read the Frankfurt School, Adorno, Max Horkheimer, and so on, Marcuse, if he'd read them earlier, he probably would have been led into writing in that framework and engaging with thinkers and doing, quote-unquote critical theory in that sense. So I think there's actually more links than are sometimes accepted, both by people who are very strong on Foucault and by others who are just, really strong Marxists and who think that Foucault is a kind of, revisionist or whatever. But there are links there, and there's ways to make use of both of them, I think. And the interesting thing about Foucault is the way in which he conceptualizes things which don't just come down to class in historical materialist terms. So I think if you can bring yourself around to that, I think there's a lot to learn from that.
I think for my part, the one thing that I get from Foucault that I don't get from Marx and actually challenges Marxist theory is Foucault's anti-ideology about language. And you get this in Deleuze as well. And it's pretty clear to me that there's some cross-pollination between Deleuze and Foucault on this point. I see Foucault as cautioning us against a reduction of institutional languages, for example, to what we might call their semiotic elements, reducing those semiotic elements to ideology, that is. Like Deleuze, Foucault says that ideology presupposes a false obfuscation of power through language. So what we might otherwise call ideological aspects of power, I think, are better construed as maybe productive apparatuses of power. And I know Foucault has this quote where he says, it's more and less than ideology when it comes to language. So what we refer to when we say ideology involves, I think, methods of programming and the production of real effects. The production of political subjects involves the institution of habits, routines, circulation of knowledge. And these are all effects that we experience and factor into a broader notion of political economy. And so for me, I think when you look at somebody like Foucault and Deleuze, it calls into question what a political economy is. I don't think, for example, Marx could have seen the rise of something like social media. Maybe he could have. I would grant him that. But to be able to conceptualize the effects that social media, for example, has had upon the populace and how those effects get folded back into the economy, I think require empirical analysis. So for me, it's ultimately about the way that institutional languages function. And so with that said, maybe we'll just kind of wrap things up. Maybe Will or Matt, you have something to finalize this episode with.
Yeah, I wanted to just dive in there a little bit. Just, I want to defend Marx there, or Marxism there, because most Marx, there's a difference between like Marx and Marxism, right? So within Marxism, as a school of thought, there have been many, many different thinkers and contributors. And many of them have, thought about the role of language, of culture, and all other sort of social issues, gender and race and so on, in really, really interesting and sophisticated ways, right? So it isn't that Marxism is immune or ignorant of these issues. They do think about them. It's interesting to me that Craig just mentioned the idea of habits and, you know, habituation in the ways in which we sort of perceive the world, right? I mean, that's Althusser to a T, right? That is exactly what Althusser says about ideology. For Althusser, ideology, in a way, he will kind of build in a sort of semiotic element to it, but really, it doesn't even need the semiotic element. For Althusser, ideology is a fully materialist practice or habit, really, to do with your relations towards others and institutions and the way which you respond and so on. And so, it's not really about that. You know, just as a little bit of a defense there, I think, you know, these are issues which do come up in Marxist literature and theory. They have been thought about and discussed. Many of them will actually use Foucault, actually. You know, Negri, for example, will use Foucault quite extensively, particularly the other autonomists as well. So I guess that's one of my, I don't really have like a formal final thought on this, other than to say, you absolutely should read Foucault. this chapter's great. It's a really good distillation of many of his thoughts on the relation between power and politics and medicine and so on. And also that, you know, read Marx, read Marxism too. I don't think, personally, I don't see a fundamental conflict there. I think you can read both and learn an enormous amount by doing both.
Sure. Yeah, I almost feel compelled to defend myself, but I might just let myself take the hit in this case. I do agree with you.
I mean, there have been. It's okay.
I mean, I agree. There are some Marxists who abide in an orthodox version of Marxism. And then there are people who think that folks like Althusser and Hart and Negri are revisionists and do not take those theories very seriously.
Yeah.
And the other thing maybe to say is that maybe when we talk about what Althusser does with language, when we say that language is ideology versus language has these real effects, then maybe we're having a verbal dispute of some kind at that point. But
yeah.
I don't want to belabor the point.
for Althusser, language is still material. No, he's not an idealist conception of language. It's still material. I'll leave it there. Other than to say, actually, just one last thing is that, you know, given the current circumstances, C.L.R. James was a really, really fantastic and thoughtful writer from Trinidad and Tobago, Marxist as well, who wrote a lot about Marxism and race, and conflict, as well as some great books about cricket as well. so I'll probably end on that one myself.
I think all I want to end with here, and I think it's a good way to understand Foucault's issue with power analytics before his time, comes out of another essay in this chapter, which is a series of conversations. So interviews are generally less conducive, but I just want to pull this one out. If one tries to erect a theory of power, one will always be obliged to view it as emerging at a given place and time, and hence deduce it to reconstruct its genesis. But if power is in reality an open or more or less coordinated cluster of relations, then the only problem is to provide oneself with a grid of analysis, which makes possible an analytic of relations of power. And I think this comes down to the central tension even between you, Craig, and Matt, because it does come down to a desire to find alterations in discourse that feed into power relations that are more or less complex. You know, ideology separates itself, particularly in Althusser's construction of it, and we'd be well-served to do an episode on that. But I think one thing that Foucault provides us with is the complexity of power relations, the fact that power tacitly doesn't exist in a concrete sense between one individual who has it, possesses it, and another who doesn't. Overt dominations are not as overt as they may seem. And of course, this is present in texts like One Dimensional Man. So the concept of domination is a diffuse, complicated, and often invisible one. And power doesn't only tell a body no, it can sometimes make individual bodies and populations say yes, identify as particular subjects. So I think what one should be left with Foucault, among a lot of other things, is a really unique interpretation of the role power plays in social production.
And that will conclude our examination of Michel Foucault's The Politics of Health and an impromptu discussion of his essay, What is Enlightenment? As promised, I want to take a moment to acknowledge and thank our supporting patrons by name. On behalf of all of us at Acid Horizon, I'd like to thank Aslakum Kadmi, Anthony Gavin, and Jay Conway for being our first gracious supporters. Also, we would like you to look forward to upcoming episodes on Mark Fisher's Post-Capitalist Desire and Matt Colquhoun's book on Mark Fisher, Egress. Since all of us are quite new to podcasting, we welcome any suggestions that you have for texts that you would like to hear us explore. So feel free to drop us a line on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or on our Patreon account. This month, Patreon subscribers will get access to an album I've created of a lot of the ambient and lo-fi music that you hear featured on the show from my solo act, Serepti. The album is 20 tracks long, so if you'd like to receive it, just subscribe to us and become a patron for as little as $1. We'll see you next time.